I did have, there were some other requests I haven't spoken to, if you want me, you know, that were brought out by the committee at the last meeting, if you want to go to that.
Yeah.
Can't crimes and vision under any of these sections climb up into the hundreds and thousands of dollars?
Yes.
Yet we only have, we have a max of ammunition.
Yes. Well, one approach, and this has been suggested by Mr. Hickey, would be to simply apply the general theft provisions to this. In other words, you know, if it was over $500, it became a felony. Similarly, if it was under $50, it would become a misdemeanor. Most states use a simple provision, a misdemeanor, you know, regardless of the amount of property. The federal criminal code, which is just passed the Senate, does have felony penalties if it's a substantial amount of property. In particularly serious instances of this type of conduct, though, you could prosecute a person under theft. Although I think you may have some problems proving with property of another. Certainly in security interest, fraud on a secured creditor, you couldn't. Perhaps though on judgment creditors and fraud insolvency, it could be argued that it's property of another. But I think it would be very difficult to make that argument.
Well, we sort of made a policy decision, at least in this committee, that we're going to delineate $50 and $500.
Yeah.
It seems like we should do that here.
Yes. Well, I could, you know, I don't know if you consider that a classification issue or not. I think that's a valid point. That if you say you defraud someone out of, you know, security interest, and it's a $7,000 type of interest, you know, watching them be treated.
Yeah.
The problem is, though, is that the kind of conduct that you're talking about is not necessarily, it may hamper enforcement of the interest, but it's not necessarily going to defeat it. In other words, if you look at like the different way the adjectives are, it's conceal, removes, encumbers, conveys, or other deal, or otherwise deals with this property with intent to defraud an existing judgment creditor. You could convey the property to your wife, say, to defraud a judgment creditor, or to a relative, say, and then the judgment creditor would have the transfer set aside later on as an invalid transfer. You are still committed to crime.
Right.
Yeah. And whereas the theft, you're talking more about, I think, you won't have the legal remedy to have that transfer set aside.
Well, you can also, on the other hand, you can also convey a $100,000 home to, or I can to Larry, with an intention to borrow somebody and pull it off, and
yes.
I should be in time. I think much more seriously than that.
The reason I'm, you know, I guess maybe playing devil's advocate on this is that Mr. Brown thought that these crimes shouldn't even belong in the criminal code. There was certainly a feeling on in the subcommission that these crimes should be left, you know, the civil remedies should apply. The answer to that is that civil remedies are usually inadequate. There were two questions, though, that remained. One was from Mr.
Do you want to discuss those points?
Well, when that question is just too long.
Which one?
Well, we're talking about here.
Well, the three statutes.
Yeah.
Well,
we already have this, and it's over.
The fraud and secured creditors is now an existing law. I don't know the penalty. I'll look it up in a second. The fraud and judgment creditors is not specifically a crime under existing. It is not a crime under existing law, but the transfer would be invalid. Similarly, with fraud and insolvency, it is not a crime under existing law.
The transfer may be invalidated by a court, but it may not, in fact, be physically possible to invalidate that transfer.
Oh, sure.
If I sold my $100,000 boat to somebody who is down in Guadalajara, breaking barnacles off the bottom.
Yes. I'm just trying to get the penalty structure for you. Ed, you had a question as to, isn't there a similar provision on judgment credit on security interest in Title 28? Of the card, and I did the research on that. And in fact, there's if you can prove an intent to defraud, it's a 2-year maximum. See, the thing is here is that you don't have to prove an intent to defraud. You simply have to prove that you took it out of the state with intent to hinder enforcement of the interest, not necessarily an intent to defraud. I mean, I feel it's two different proof requirements.
Well, most of these kind of cases, you may start with misdemeanor, but there'd be a lot of civil action following.
Yes.
Yeah.
The maximum penalty for security interest fraud under existing law now is a year.
Bill?
Yeah, I'd like to include
classification penalty.
Okay, why don't we take that up when we take that classification?
Okay, the amendment actually is a purely a technical one in terms of using the similar adjectives throughout.
Yeah, move the amendment number one. Any discussion on the amendment?
I thought I gave a copy.
The one that we just handed out.
Yeah. The amendment just uses the same verb, removes, conceals, encompasses, conveys, or otherwise deals with. Throughout, we use sometimes slightly different.
A little bit more discussion here. Would you, in response to Ian's question, under present law, existing law, the action is just void.
Yes.
That's the way it is now. Now, at this point, we make it a criminal penalty. So I'm going to very give us a hypothetical of a person who is committing a crime of defrauding a judgment creditor.
Yeah. There's a lawsuit. Judgment has been entered against me for $200,000. At that time, the person that I have to say the plaintiff in the suit, and I was the defendant, he is the plaintiff in the suit. Would be a judgment creditor of me, I would be the judgment debtor. I would transfer the property, say, to my some property I had that would go to pay off that judgment. I would transfer it, say, to a relative with intent to defraud the existing judgment creditor. Is that a correct example, Jim? You seem to be.
Yeah, I do think you should be aware that some things will continue to be legal. You may convert property that you own, which is not exempt from execution, into exempt property, if you want. That is, if you have a lot of money lying around, that's not exempt. So you could use that to buy tools of your trade, and that would be exempt from execution. There's nothing criminal about that. In fact, the lawyers will have to counsel a client to do that if he's contemplating bankruptcy. So I mean, you're not prohibiting all forms of converting property here that might end up making a judgment creditor get left out of his judgment.
The statute's not directed that
would,
way.
You know.
The statute's not directed that way.
No. I point out that there's still debtor protections in the law that are not being affected by this.
Maybe that goes to the fact that, defrauding judgment creditors, that we should have a provision that somehow refers to. But right now, it's say you convey it with an intent to fraud. Well, you may have an intent to fraud, but it may be, you know, an intent to use deception is an intent to fraud. But in fact, you may be allowed to do that.
Well, it may be nothing deceptive about it.
Okay.
You intend to see that this judgment creditor does not get his due.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean you're using deception or fraud.
Right.
You're doing a legal thing.
That's right.
Converting non-exempt property into exempt property. What's illegal is the transfer, a phony transfer to somebody.
Every revised code has a provision on defrauding security creditors. That's universal. As to judgment creditors, I'd say probably the most 50% do. As to fraud and insolvency, I think very few do. I think what's felt is the gift protection to business people, you know. that would be the feeling on the commission at least.
Thank you.
damn thing.
I don't think any of these could be irrevocable.
Well, not if it's a legal matter, but if someone took the property to Guadalajara, you know, you can declare that transfer void, but it's tough getting cooperation out of Guadalajara in court to go.
Well, with this one instance, if my wife tells me that she's going to divorce me, and she says that we're going to get a divorce, and I think some of our property is getting filed, and saying that I get to be
it's not a cover.
But they don't notice that. Yeah, it isn't. It isn't. Where is
the cover?
Given notice, or?
Yeah, not, yeah, unfortunately, though, we're not defined that says that.
You have to be an existing judgment creditor. You have a judgment.
Okay. After your divorce is settled, and she had got the house, and then we got sobered out on it.
Well, I'm glad to know. I think that would be a problem.
Okay, is there any objection to amendment number one? Okay, no objection to amendment
we're going to classification.
Well, when we discuss the classification issue, I understand that it's a classification issue problem.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I just wondered, actually, while we're at it, are there other property crimes in the code besides this that
we haven't done?
No, that we may want to apply to theft?
Yes, you may.
Value structure.
Yes,
okay,
you may.
I think when we bring it up that we should look at all of them and decide if we want to apply this to all the property kind of thing.
May I make just one observation here? That when you're dealing with this kind of conduct, defrauding judgment creditors, secured creditors, it is unlikely that you're going to have a person that is going to be defrauding a judgment creditor out of $50, which is a... So perhaps when we do our structure, we really only have 2 degrees there, an A misdemeanor for under 500 and a C felony for over 500. And even though the A misdemeanor one would cover, you know, theoretically the person that's defrauding a judgment creditor for less than $50, I doubt very much that is going to in fact occur. Instead of having 2 degrees of the crime, I'm saying, instead of having 3 degrees of the crime, I'm saying having 2. Although if we are going to create a super degree of theft, that same super degree of theft is going to apply probably to this crime too, so we have 3 anyway. But this is my line. Terry, we've done credit cards. The general provisions, at this point in time, I'm not ready to discuss, but there are going to be very few changes. I'm talking about page 85 through 88. I only anticipate, though, a few minor technical changes on it, but I'm not ready this time to do it, since some of those general provisions apply to things that we haven't gone back to amendments yet. So I'd like to move to family pensions. That's on 88. The first one is aims in the welfare of a minor. I didn't have any notes of anyone having problems with. The crime that I have problems with, and I think that in testimony you've heard an average that other people may have problems with, is the aims in the welfare of a minor in the second degree. And I do have a amendment on that that I'd like you to get considered.
This is another place, one of the two places I'm supposed to use criminal amendments.
Yes, my amendment knocked it out, essentially. Except for
what are the remaining places you have? Criminal negligence and homicide.
Yes. Sure. One type of assault, I know there's one form of assault when you use a gun. There's also criminally negligently allowing escape, which we will be getting to in a few minutes.
What year are you on page 85?
88. What this amendment does is a number of things. Number one, it changes the culpability requirement for the statute. As originally drafted, criminal negligence applied to all 4 ways the crime could be committed. I have just applied criminal negligence to the first subsection there, which is leaving the child under circumstances that create substantial risk of physical injury. Subsection 2 and subsection 3, I think it was ridiculous to apply a criminal negligence standard there. I mean, how could you criminally negligently impose cruel punishment on a child? It just seemed like to be a contradiction. I've also taken out subsection 4, deprive the child of necessary food, clothing, or shelter, because I believe that maybe some instances of that would already be included under subjecting the child to cruel punishment, which is subsection 3.
I don't agree with that.
And additionally, we have a separate statute on criminal non-support, which makes it an A misdemeanor to do that when it's a person legally charged with the support of a child under 18. If you turn to page 89 of the bill, there's a separate statute, criminal non-support, which is an A misdemeanor. And Mr. Vaden specifically pointed out the contradiction between having a B misdemeanor in endangering the welfare of a minor in the second degree and an A misdemeanor in criminal non-support.
So he just also pointed, like you have up in A, anyone under age of 10, he intentionally deserts the child in any place under circumstances creating a substantial risk of physical injury to the child.
No,
he brought up the point that if you were to leave your child at home, a 9-year-old kid at home and went to the store or something, I guess you could be charged.
No, that's not correct.
Well, that was the point that he was making, yeah, that you could, but yeah, if you went down below here, and you could be charged for misdemeanor for doing much more cruel things.
No, I don't.
You have a copy of what he said, maybe I didn't read that well.
You're right.
Yeah, that's what he said, but I'm saying that his analysis is not correct.
Okay.
First of all, first degree section requires an intentional desertion. Intentional desertion is an intent to give up the child. It is not an intent simply to leave it alone for a few hours. Number two, you have to do it under circumstances which create a substantial risk of physical injury to the child. I think the example Mr. Bates gave does not fit into that category. The second, I agree. I think that frankly, if you want to know my amendment is to knock out two and three, because subjecting the child to cruel confinement or subjecting the child to cruel punishment should be treated as a form of assault. And I think it detracts from that to have a specific reference here. And this was fought over, Terry could attest to this, that this went back and forth on the commission. First we were having it in, then we knocked it out, then we put it in. I think it's upsetting to say that if you subject the child to cruel punishment, it's a B misdemeanor, and yet we have an assault provision that says it's an A misdemeanor, if you cause physical injury to anyone.
I think that is a problem.
There is one problem, though, I should bring up that bothers me if you knock it out. And you should consider this. What about the situation where the mother smears feces on the child's face? What is that?
What did you get? How quick?
That's arguably an assault, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's an argument. That's an assault.
Really good that test.
In terms of the
What I'm suggesting is in very demanding, and I think he suggests
two, you delete paragraphs two and three of subsection A. And I think that's a good idea.
I do not think
it's a good idea to have paragraphs two and three as they're currently drafted. I think it'd be better if you're going to have criminal negligence rather than knowing.
Okay. So you're both recommending then that we delete two and three of 110. And we keep 110 as a D misdemeanor, but the only thing it says is that subsection one of criminal negligence releases the child unattended.
Mr. Chairman, I think that I'd like to first decide two and three, and then I'd like to speak to one.
Well, I'm just trying to get an overview of what we got left when we get
down. Yeah, I could argue that one is unnecessary.
Oh, okay.
Well, we have a crime of reckless endangerment in the code, and reckless endangerment covers conduct, and I'll quote it. I'm not saying it's as broad as the criminal negligence crime. Reckless endangerment says, person commits a crime of reckless endangerment if he recklessly engages in conduct which creates substantial risk of serious physical injury to another person. Okay, now if subsection 1 is knocked out, just the reckless endangerment subsection would apply. Now, that is the reckless culpability, and it's obviously a harder form of culpability than criminal negligence. You may simply want to just have the general reckless endangerment provision apply and not use criminal negligence here. And just treat it as any other form of reckless endangerment.
Yeah.
Of course, the fact is you're dealing with minor hearing, perhaps that justifies the special treatment in this subsection.
All right. We have a motion before.
Well, no, not if you keep subsection one there. And you're dealing with minors, and perhaps you want to have, originally as I drafted this section, it simply said it was criminal negligence to leave the child unattended under such circumstances, as the amendment would look if you knocked out two or three. I think when you are dealing with minors, you want to require for proof a lower form of culpability to protect the children. That if the parents leave and they should have been aware of a risk that the children were exposed to a substantial risk of physical injury, that should give rise to culpability.
How much information force do you have for second degree?
It was very debated on whether we should have it or not. It was very interesting. The mechanics of it, I'll never understand.
It was very controversial, but it was somewhat controversial because of the different subsects. You know, because of the way it ended up, it had all these different subsects.
It's
like one thing in kids is it's like fish. Everybody thinks they're an expert on it because they only got kids. And there's these horror cases about garbage cans and closets and change of beds and not feeding kids. And, you know, you get all involved in this. It's very entangling. Well, a lot of that kind of is covered under assault or some other thing. But I think the basic issue on subsection one. Some of the conduct that would be covered under subsection 1 is covered under other statutes, not just reckless endangerment, but this is broader because it's actually lower
culpability. And also, don't have to expose more of the physical injury, not material.
So this is going to cover some conduct that would not otherwise be covered.
This was the most, in terms of trying to decide what to criminalize, this was one area where everyone just had different opinions, especially even the experts in the field. Some say you shouldn't have special provisions. What good is it going to do if you put the parents in jail under those circumstances?
If this is to do with feeding your child and running an automobile while you're going to the grocery store, I'd be okay with that.
I gave an example in a commentary where I think it covered. And that was the example of leaving the kid in the automobile in dead winter for a couple of hours. And I don't think it would cover the example.
Do that.
approach that it was 10 in first degree. It was 10 in first degree because it felt that above that age, the child could call attention to his wife and fend for himself, whereas 13, I don't really know what 13 is still in there.
I think maybe the good end first degree when it really matters, down in the above, but second degree, I think maybe the first one is still up, not quite 13, maybe 10.
Well, I mean, maybe it's just like, oh, I could mean it's just like one. I mean, it is, you should have second degree and 10 too.
If you were going to raise it.
I think it was, they were both at 13, but just, it was said that you can't really desert a 13-year-old. I mean, it's, you know, at some point that desertion, you know, isn't just really like to happen. I think that was reasonably low. And most kids can't keep their 13-year-old home, let alone desert them and leave them at home.
I want to ask you a question on the, you know, police are often calling and helping folks to say, start at home.
Maybe some aggravated instances you want to prosecute. Speaking to these quote experts in the field, it seems to be that when you threaten someone with a criminal prosecution, it doesn't have the effect you want it to have. You know, in other words, saying if you don't take care of your kid, we're going to prosecute you. But that does not have the effect of having to take care of your child.
You know, I don't think this was what you're telling them. Yeah. It was just that some people are needed. You know, we shouldn't use the other mechanisms to deal with it, but that. And there was another feeling that, you know, some of these people might be punished for doing it.
Well, I'd like to think that that's a very child abuse of that factor. If you know that to do those things, you might get arrested. And I think some people will pay a little more attention to that.
I think the other argument was that this was an option, and that it probably wouldn't be, it probably wouldn't criminally prosecute people for doing a lot of these things, but if the prosecution or somebody wanted to bring
legally charged with the support of a child under 18 who refuses or neglects an unlawful excuse to provide support for the child.
Well, I just asked Ms. Trevor to accept the minute that they had trouble voting on.
I have heard of amendments.
Let me dispose of this, please. Do a motion, and then make that one. So we have a call. Is there any objection then to amendment number 6? If there's no objection, then okay, Larry?
Offer amendment. I get the offer amendment to 661.
Change 13 to 10. What we're working out now is amendment number 2, which deletes 2 and 3. Mr. Carpenter's made a motion to change 13 to 10.
Well, you didn't want to change 10 to 13.
Agreement.
public service, you know, whether that would be due to bribery. In other words, Terry agrees to vote for a motion to bed, the bed votes for a motion, Terry, is that benefit? Well, I suggest an amendment to take care of that. I've also included on the amendment commentary from the other copies here. I'm gonna send it down, I was thinking, but the
Number three. Yeah, this is today, this is
February 22,
amendment.
That's the date.
What a short amendment, what a long explanation.
No, the explanation is gonna be amended, really. The problem is that benefit, which is defined, okay, in order to go to a bribe, you have to offer a benefit. Benefit is defined in the code on page 131 as a present or future gain or advantage to the beneficiary or to the third person pursuant to the desire of the beneficiary. Well, benefit arguably covers a cup of coffee over, during a discussion about a political issue. And what I did is I included the commentary from the subcommittee here on how we tried to deal with that problem. And I think it's important that it becomes part of the record because it reflects the intent of the subcommittee on this to exclude such items from the scope of the bribery statute. The problem is that it's very difficult to exclude, the insignificant cup of coffee from the bribery statute and yet include other types of benefits. The amendment, though, speaks to another issue, and that is it makes a technical change in the definition of benefit by adding a new subsection which excludes from benefit political campaign contributions, which were originally excluded from the definition of benefit. The problem was that we defined benefit in the general definition, and that exclusion of political campaign contributions should only apply to the bribery section, should not apply to other provisions for benefit abuse. Now, subsection 2 is added to exclude the instances of log rolling, which I just discussed in the beginning. And that's from the Federal Criminal Code, and that's how they dealt with that problem. I think it's a good one, just specifically excluded. And again, the commentary that's included tries to explain the commission's intent regarding benefits that may be viewed as creating a climate for discussion.
What you talked about, you don't have to commit a crime. I haven't seen anything wrong with anybody, we set it up as a crime. I haven't seen anything wrong with the guy trying to,
let me read this in statute.
You have to get your thumb with the intent to vote.
Well, I think that's what the commentary goes.
Why don't we put state employees in here particularly?
Well, it says public servants.
If they influence my vote.
Well, if it comes within the coverage of the bribery statute, it's bribery. They give you $1,000 to do bribery to vote on something. But number one, that term is not a culpable mental state that is used in the code. Number two, it's been felt that bribes should uncorrupt, bribes that are not corrupt be covered. In other words, I give you $1,000 to get a child daycare center, to vote for a child daycare center. It could be argued that that's not a corrupt, your intention is not corrupt there if you want to benefit daycare centers. So no code includes that adjective corruptly in terms of referring to the state of mind that you have to get the bribe with. But the use of law refers to gift, gratuity, or valuable consideration, or other things.
I really have a real conscious problem of reversing any time in the public.
where they are now.
Benefit in bribery, as well as the benefit level.